there could have been anyone out there, people getting ready for hunting camp. Again, they're not even sure what the cause is at this point.
Fire officials suspect a large interior blaze was human-caused. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 30th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, hikers maintain vigilance in bear country.
Sarah's got the bear spray. I've got a 44, and we've talked about what our plan would be if we do see a bear.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Two men who allegedly had 33 pounds of methamphetamine in a backpack after leaving a ferry in Whittier made their initial court appearances today in Anchorage. Whittier police arrested 27-year-old Eric James Hansen and 40-year-old Marshall Park on Thursday. Federal authorities say Hansen brought the meth, worth nearly $250,000 in wholesale quantities, from Bellingham, Washington to Whittier on the state ferry Kennecott. The ferry made stops in southeast Alaska on its way to Whittier, the closest state ferry terminal to Anchorage, about 60 miles away. According to the charges, Alaska Marine Highway employees notified Whittier police about a suspicious passenger. That passenger later turned out to be Hansen, the charges say. The charging document does not say what made Hansen seem suspicious, but it notes he had been seen with the backpack in the Whittier ferry terminal. The charges say Park was driving a GMC Yukon with Alaska license plates when police stopped the SUV, and Hansen was in the passenger seat. An unnamed woman rode him back. The charging document says police brought in a drug-sniffing dog that indicated the odor of narcotics coming from the vehicle. The charges say that after getting a search warrant, police found the backpack filled with meth, as well as $8,000 cash in a briefcase. The vehicle also allegedly contained a scale with drug residue on it, a glass pipe with burnt edges, and a small baggie with white powder. Both Park and Hansen are charged with possession with intent to distribute and conspiracy to distribute 500 grams or more of methamphetamine. Several suspects are in custody in connection with a North Pole murder. Alaska state troopers report that a multi-agency investigation resulted in the arrest of six people, including two juveniles, related to the July 22nd fatal shooting of 60-year-old Charles Baptiste at a North Pole residence. Troopers say the six were involved in a plot to rob Baptiste. Baptiste was killed, and another man at the residence sustained a non-fatal gunshot wound. The suspects face a mix of charges, including murder and assault. A company working on road construction on the Sterling Highway says its gravel trucks were not responsible for the rock that hit a car and killed an 8-year-old boy inside. The Associated Press reports Noah Schwabach of Eagle River was killed earlier this month after a large rock fell off an oncoming truck and crashed through the small car's windshield. Granite Construction says it has conducted an internal investigation, finding that it had only one truck involved in the project at the time. The company says that truck did not match witness descriptions. Its truck was traveling empty at the time. Alaska state troopers have said the truck involved was tentatively identified, but they did not give the name of the operator. Alaska is headed toward an unusually competitive primary in just over 3 weeks, and that competition is mostly within the Republican Party. To understand what may be driving this, Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman is here. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Casey.
Let's start at the top of the ticket. What's going on there?
Both of the competitive primaries for governor and lieutenant governor are in the Republican Party. There are seven Republican candidates running to be governor and six from the party running to be lieutenant governor. Most of the attention right now is focused on the leading candidates for governor. That's former Wasilla Senator Mike Dunleavy and former Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell of Anchorage. Dunleavy has built up a lead, according to polls. Treadwell is trying to make up ground, arguing that he's better qualified. There could have been a primary on the Democratic side, but Independent Governor Bill Walker decided to file directly for the general election. That leaves Mark Begich to be the Democratic candidate, and a major issue to watch in the fall is whether the competition between Walker and Begich increases the chances for the Republican primary winner.
Moving on to the legislature, how competitive are those elections?
There are 109 primary candidates running for seats in the House, and that's the highest number since 1996. 24 of the 29 competitive primaries between the Senate and the House are between Republicans. I talked with Alaska Republican Party Chairman Tuckerman Babcock about what's causing the interest. He gave two reasons. One is the fact that the House had a Democratic speaker for the first time in 24 years. Here's Babcock.
There's a lot of interest and excitement in taking the House back, and that's generated candidates.
He says the second reason is debates within the Republican Party. That's happened on whether to focus on repealing the 2016 law, which is known as Senate Bill 91. That, of course, overhauled the state's criminal justice system. And there's also been a debate on whether to restore permanent fund dividends to the amount set by the formula that was used until 2016. The Alaska Republican Party has voted to take the position that dividends should be restored to the full amount.
What other reasons could be driving the competitive primaries?
I asked Babcock about whether candidates are concerned about the extraordinary number of days the legislature has been in session. Last year was a record high. He said the long sessions actually discourage some candidates from running because they don't want to spend so much of the year in session. But he said it may have motivated others to run with the goal of working to end the session sooner.
So what are the potential bigger picture implications of this primary?
Well, it could have the result of reducing the size of the House majority coalition even before we get to the general election. That's because two Republicans who joined the House majority are facing challengers who plan to caucus with the Republican Party. Representative Louise Stutes in Kodiak is facing challenger Richard Walker, and Representative Gabrielle Ledoux in Anchorage faces challenger Aaron Weaver.
Are there any other specific primary races that stand out as particularly noteworthy?
In the Senate, there's a lot of interest in the Republican primary for the district based in Eagle River, where Anna McKinnon is stepping down. Two House members, Dan Sadler and Laura Reinbold, are competing to move up to replace her. And that's created two competitive House primaries to replace them. On the Democratic side, the most competitive primaries may be in the districts that represent downtown Anchorage to replace Les Guerra and downtown Juneau to replace Sam Keto III.
All right. Well, Andrew, thanks for the update.
You're welcome, Casey.
Alaska Public Media will have more stories focusing on the competitive races before primary day on August 21st. Andrew Kitchenman is the Capitol reporter for KTOO and Alaska Public Media. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Anchorage cannabis entrepreneur is looking to set up the first shop in Bethel.
We're actually pretty excited, so it's going to be nice to tell folks when they come in and ask, when are you coming? Well, we're on our way.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station, ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Officials suspect that the 15,000-acre Tuxhilda Hill fire near Tok is human-caused. Fire Information Officer Jim Schwarber says lightning does not appear to be a factor in the blaze, which started May 23rd.
We have a lightning detection system in place for the entire state of Alaska that records every lightning strike, and they went back several weeks and there had been no strikes in that area.
Schwarber says the fire began in a remote roadless spot east of Tuxhilda Hill, but that does not discount the potential of a human cause.
There is an Avalon development group that's doing mineral exploration on Tetlin tribal lands and the corporation lands, but there could have been anyone out there, people getting ready for hunting camp. Again, they're not even sure what the cause is at this point.
Schwarber says federal investigators were expected on scene as early as today. Meanwhile, 131 firefighters are trying to keep flames away from two nearby native land allotments. He says that starts with cutting line around the allotment.
Cleared the trees from that area. They'll plumb a hose lay, which basically means there'll be water pumps from the river and hose and nozzles stretched around the entire perimeter of the allotment. When the weather conditions are appropriate, meaning the proper low RH and the winds in the proper direction, they will, you know, burn out away from the native allotment along that line with using drip torches.
Schwarber says the set fire can be allowed to burn back to the main fire front or put out with aerial water drops. The weather is hot and dry, and Schwarber says managers are assessing additional properties that could be threatened.
We're now moving over to Jodiman Lake, which is southwest of the fire, and there's one native allotment and four cabins on that lake.
Schorber says they're also looking at what it would take to protect native allotments northeast of the fire toward the village of Northway. He says wind and thunderstorms are forecast beginning Wednesday with potential for rain next week. If you live in Alaska, you live in bear country. The risk of a bear encounter or attack is low, but there's always a chance the worst could happen. Three people have been killed by bears since last summer, with the latest just last month in Eagle River. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell spoke to hikers there about the risks you take when you head out onto the trails.
It's just a stunning day out here. Not too much wind, not too much sun. Surprisingly, no bugs, which is pretty incredible for an Alaskan summer.
Yeah, it's beautiful, it's sunny, it's green.
Lonnie Quinn is an Eagle River local. She grew up in this valley and knows these trails. That's why she didn't second guess going out alone in late June.
You were by yourself?
Yeah, just he was over there, I was right here.
Quinn points just across the valley. That's where a man went missing on a hike that same day.
Good evening, everyone. This is a tragic story we've been tracking all day. The search for a missing Eagle River hiker comes to a very sad end.
44-year-old Michael Soltis went hiking on Monday in Eagle River outside Anchorage, but he did not return.
A bear killed Michael Soltis and mauled a member of the search party looking for him. Deadly bear attacks are considered rare in Alaska, happening once every 3 to 4 years. But just last year, there were two, one outside Anchorage and the other in the interior.
50 years ago, who was jogging in the woods? Who was riding bikes in the woods? Basically nobody.
Rick Sinnott is a retired wildlife biologist. He says, sure, it's possible the number of human-bear encounters are up, but there's also just more humans here.
We have two or three or four times more people in Anchorage. There's way more people in the woods.
And those people can leave scraps of food on the trails or unattended in campgrounds, which means bears get more habituated. Just weeks after the last death here, these woods are packed with people. And it's no surprise why. The trail starts out in a forest of bright white birch and dark green spruce. It climbs along a clear, cold stream, perfect for cooling off on a hot day. That's where I find Sarah Smith. She's got a colorful sleeve of tattoos up her right arm and a can of bear spray strapped to her hips.
It's not a matter of, you know, if, it's a matter of when you're going to have an encounter.
Smith is planning on camping overnight here in this valley with her friend Seth Ransom and their two dogs.
Sarah's got the bear spray. I've got a 44, and you know, we've talked about what our plan would be if we do see a bear. We're going to get together, see if we can get the dogs with us, and then we'll have the spray first. Firearm second, hopefully never have to use it.
Ransom actually trains people for a living on how to stay safe in the backcountry. He tells his clients, though, that having too many bear deterrents, that can be a bad thing.
If you have an air horn, you have a firearm, you have a whistle, you have a bear spray, in the moment, you're not going to know which one to go for.
Out here today, some people have bells on their dogs' collars, others have guns strapped to their chest or slung over their shoulders. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Guide to Staying Safe in Bear Country focuses on bear spray and firearms as the top deterrents. Despite the hype of bear stories on social media and the recent death, hikers here say they're mostly not afraid.
I really just think you have to keep perspective. Otherwise, you know, I would just have fear and paranoia.
Eagle River local Lonnie Quinn again. Over the hundreds of hikes she's gone on, she says she's only seen 5 or 6 bears.
That's the way I kind of rationalize it, because I love being outside and I love hiking and I don't want to give up what I love so much just because I'm afraid of running into something that probably doesn't want anything to do with me anyway.
There's a cow and 2 moose calves up along the ridge, but no signs of bears on this day. It's an added relief on top of the hike's grand finale.
We just came across this little bridge and now we're getting a view of Eagle Lake, which is just this tropical, bright blue.
In Eagle River, I'm Emily Russell.
Bristol Bay's strong salmon returns stand in contrast to other parts of Alaska where the fish have trickled in slowly or seemingly not at all. Statewide, though, we're seeing some of the smallest-sized fish on record across species. KDLG's Austin Fast has the story.
It's been a year for the Bristol Bay record books as total sockeye runs surpassed 61 million on Thursday, putting it just a 500,000 fish behind 1980's largest run ever. Burt Lewis oversees commercial fisheries in Bristol Bay, Cook Inlet, and Prince William Sound for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He's impressed at the Nooshkak run's strength and even at the bay's east side districts, which he says came in late but solidly.
That stands out really statewide, where sockeye runs have not been strong. I know that westward Kodiak area is meeting their goals, but with very little fishing opportunity. Cook Inlet right now is under restrictions. We look at other species, king salmon statewide are of concern with low returns, but meeting goals solidly in Bristol Bay.
King salmon escapement was strong enough that 100 anglers filled the Nooshigak River this June for a new King Derby, even as poor returns canceled a handful of derbies in southeast Alaska. Lewis says the prevailing theory for Bristol Bay's bounty is the blob, an unusually warm water mass that filled the northern Gulf of Alaska as this year's returning fish migrated out to sea a few years back.
We know that it tends to disrupt food webs that support the forage base that the juvenile salmon feed on. And the fact that we see that pretty consistently across southeast and the north Gulf, and yet Bristol Bay, we're not seeing that. Well, the warm blob, this warm water anomaly, was not present in the Bering Sea where those fish came out.
Anecdotally, fishermen have been telling us all summer their red salmon seems smaller than in years past, but Lewis confirms it. In fact, he says the issue cuts across species statewide, with some of the smallest sizes on record. Besides affecting fishermen's wallets, those smaller fish returning to Alaska's river systems directly impact processors' bottom lines, Lewis says.
A processing plant can handle so many fish per day, and once you reach that capacity, you're pretty much topped out. And ecologically, each female that comes back is going to have less eggs, so their overall reproductive potential could be declining. And what are the ecological implications of that is unknown.
What Lewis can say with certainty is that strong returns and increasing prices over the last 5 years are raising the value of Bristol Bay salmon. He says this year's ex-vessel value is among the top five in Bristol Bay's history since they began keeping records around the turn of the century. He busts out a calculator to punch in the fish harvest so far, 40 million, times the average sockeye weight of 5.5 pounds, times the average price of $1.25. That puts this season at $275 million with the fish still trickling in. In the end, Lewis attributes Bristol Bay's success story to strong collaboration among ADF&G, organizations like the BBEDC and BBSRI, and the fishermen themselves.
We're all in lockstep together, and we've received a tremendous amount of support from the industry and fishing fleet.
For KDLG in Dillingham, I'm Austin Fast.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Halibut prices are seeing a slight uptick around the state. And that's good news for some fishermen after prices fell about $2 per pound at the beginning of the season. Doug Bowen works for Alaska Boats and Permits, a vessel and fishing permit broker in Homer. Bowen tracks halibut prices around the Gulf of Alaska, which have a significant influence on the halibut quota he sells for fishermen.
We did see the ex-vessel price for halibut perk up a bit, where we're at probably 6.25, 6.50, 6.75 here in Homer today.
That's up from about $5 per pound at the start of the season, which is the lowest price Pacific halibut has fetched on the docks in several years. Most of that drop has been attributed to increased competition from Atlantic halibut and a backlog of frozen product. McDowell Group fish economist Garrett Everidge says unlike this year, prices at the beginning of the season usually start high and trend downwards through the spring. But Everidge adds the recent spike in dock prices is in step with typical market fluctuations.
Maybe the market's working through some uncertainty that was present at the beginning of the season. And around this time of the year, a lot of salmon fishermen who've done halibut are busy. And so it's typically the slowest time of year, and that could be a reason why prices have appreciated a little bit.
Typically, prices drop in the fall as most salmon runs around the state come to a close and rebound as fishing effort declines toward the end of the season. Bowen says that trend would be a welcome sign.
Hopefully, as the effort spreads out there, and we'll see that price come back up, we hope. Last fall was kind of scary because the price actually dipped in the fall and never did improve. So we're hopeful that we go back to a more traditional pattern on the ex-vessel prices here this fall.
So far, fishermen in Southeast and the Central Gulf have pulled in over half of this year's total allowable catch, leaving about 3.9 million pounds to be caught before the season ends on November 7th. The ink is drying on a lease that could house Bethel's first cannabis shop. The owner of an Anchorage marijuana store wants to expand his business to Bethel and bring Alaska's booming cannabis industry to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur has more.
The question has been asked for more than a year.
When are you coming to rural Alaska?
Now, Nick Miller, owner of Alaska Buds in Anchorage, has a tentative answer. January 2019.
We're actually pretty excited, so it's going to be nice to tell folks when they come in and ask, when are you coming? Well, we're on our way.
The location will be Central Bethel on 3rd Avenue in the brown building that houses Stan's Barbershop and the Bethel Family Dental Clinic. Miller says customers can expect an experience similar to what they would find at Alaska Bud's Anchorage location.
There'll be a normal sales top glass counters, and there will be prepackaged marijuana in at least one of those counters, and there'll be other things like pipes and vape pens and just different things that go with marijuana.
He sees a high demand in the region. Already, many of his customers come from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and Miller has gotten to know the area well after working construction around the region for a decade.
And I really like it here. So I thought, well, if you're going to go to rural Alaska, why not someplace you're familiar with?
The lease comes after months of preparation. Miller has talked extensively with Bethel community members, scouted a location that meets the state and municipal requirements, and found a landowner who's comfortable with his business, John Nicholson of the neighboring Nicholson's Auto. Miller has gained a broad perspective on the cannabis industry in Alaska. In addition to his Anchorage shop, he runs a limited marijuana cultivation operation in the Matsu Valley, and he serves on the Alaska Marijuana Control Board as the industry representative. The biggest lesson that he's learned is that success in the state's cannabis industry largely depends on how you treat your neighbors and your community. Miller thinks he's helped improve both where he's already opened shop.
Number one, we cleaned up some buildings that maybe not have been in the best shape, but, you know, we have video surveillance and we have good outdoor lights. You know, my wife's now on the community council board, you know, so we participate in any chance we can.
Miller also encourages his employees to take part in community events like cleanups and heart runs. His shop buys the tickets and serves as a sponsor. Miller plans to continue this outreach in Bethel.
Even though we don't live here, you can count that we're going to be involved in the community at every opportunity.
Miller is looking to hire 6 to 8 employees in Bethel. He says a sales background is helpful, but other skills matter more.
We're looking for folks with obviously knowledge of marijuana, and they just have to be very outgoing and very helpful. You would be surprised at the amount of questions people have when they come in.
Reporting in Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Two young journalists from Pakistan recently completed their assignments in Anchorage. Tarhub Asgar and Shaista Mayrag spent 3 weeks at an Anchorage Fox News affiliate as part of an international journalism exchange through the U.S. State and Education Departments. Both reporters live and work in Lahore, the capital of Punjab. They spoke with Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend and said when they found out they were getting assigned to Alaska, they packed coats, hats, and gloves. Tarhub says she couldn't believe they were being sent here.
Why are you sending me to Alaska? It's so far away. And they were like, don't worry, people spend like thousands of dollars to go there. And you're going. We're sending you. You're such a lucky person. You have no idea. Now, whenever I think about that statement and the time I have spent here, I feel so lucky. I feel so happy that a lot of people don't get chance to come here in Alaska. It's such a beautiful place with the beautiful people, with a beautiful work as well. Because, of course, we are the ambassadors and we want to tell people like, okay, we are going happy. So that means like American people are good hosts and they're, you know, rich with culture and stuff. So I'm happy with my experience and with my attachment as well.
How about you, Shaista? How has it been for you to be here?
When I come to know that my posting is in Alaska, so I was very scared. And Alaska, the snow falling, the glaciers. Whenever Alaska comes in my mind, the glaciers are also like in my mind. I discuss it with my controller newsroom. So it's a very horrible. How could I survive there? How could I go there? It's very. He just gave me a lecture. Please stop scaring. This is not awful. People lives there, okay? But when I come here in Alaska, you can't imagine. Like when I watch the city as itself is a beautiful, not only beautiful, it is quite similar to my own like northern areas.
Tell me a little bit about some of the stories that you got to work on while you were here.
Basically, I'm a political correspondent back in Pakistan, and I did the same stuff here. The work that I have done, I have talked to governor, I have talked to senator, I have talked to, you know, representatives. I have worked on anything, not even for like here, for my own station as well. There's like a story like vote by mail, and that was like new for me. That is basically not practiced in our country. So I actually made a package for Alaska, Fox, Alaska, and also for my TV, Sama TV. I sent them. But like one thing that is like, you know, that disturbs me is like because, I don't know, the people I met here were very generous, very nice. And they're like, you know, very nice to my face. And like, but the problem is, my colleague to whom I was working with, Maria, she just told me she has lost, you know, almost like 30 to 40 followers just because of this, like, why this Muslim girl is on television. People commenting with, you know, angry faces on our packages and stuff. So that was a bit disturbing for me. Otherwise, like, I enjoyed my work. I loved it, like, how, the public officer is like easily accessible to a general public. Like it's not the same in Pakistan because we need to get through a lot of appointments and we need to get through a lot of, you know, hassle before talking to any public officer.
Tarab Asghar and Shaista Mehrag are journalists from Pakistan. They just completed a State Department reporter exchange program in Anchorage and spoke with Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Aaron Bolton in Homer, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Emily Russell in Lori Townsend in Anchorage, Austin Fast in Dillingham, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Landing a job in Alaska's high-demand industries like welding, construction, medical billing, or marine transportation is now more affordable. The University of Alaska has reduced tuition for more than 300 career and technical education courses by 25%. From Ketchikan to Kotzebue, there has never been a better time to get started on your path to a new career. Learn more at www.alaska.edu/starthere. This message brought to you by the University of Alaska. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.